I'd like to say welcome to our guest preacher for this service, Reverend Dr. John Lemon. He's the pastor of Trinity Covenant Church in Salem. And like Valley Covenant, Trinity's been worshiping online for the past year. And so as we came to this weekend when both of us were involved in the conference annual meeting, most of Friday and Saturday, we agreed that we would do some sermon sharing. And so for this Sunday, John is sharing with us a sermon that he preached last year in May from a series on the parables. John's a native of Texas, and he's previously served in Santa Barbara in California. He and his wife have four children. John enjoys books, antiques, and rock climbing. He loves being a pastor, hearing people's stories and sharing his own story. So I invite you to listen to John today. If you'd like to hear other sermons from him, there are many on their church website. I invite you to go there and listen. And now here is John's sermon text for this service. It's the gospel from Luke chapter 18, verses 9 through 14. Jesus also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and regarded others with contempt. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, was praying thus, "God, I thank you that I am not like other people, thieves, rogues, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all my income." But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even look up to heaven, but was beating his breast and saying, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." I tell you, this man went down to his home justified rather than the other. For all who exalt themselves will be humbled, but all who humble themselves will be exalted. Praise to you, Lord Christ, for your word. Now, please hear the word as it's brought to us by our friend John from Salem.
You know, as we get into our sermon today, I have been thinking a lot about misunderstandings. They can be funny. You know, a misheard word or a funny autocorrect and a once a boring conversation becomes quite spicy. Last week, I was texting with a friend of mine who told me that her and her children were making ham sanitizer. I responded, I kind of like my ham dirty, so, you know, it's funny. And then she quickly created, oh yeah, sorry, autocorrect, hand sanitizer. Some misunderstandings, though, aren't funny. Some can be quite serious, even deadly. I think about the famous climber Craig DiMartino, who miscommunicated with his belayer, allowing him to fall 100 feet off of a climb. That's like a 10-story building. He almost died. His injuries were life-threatening. He ended up losing his leg. That misunderstanding created dire consequences. That's true of our parable today. Not that it aims to create misunderstanding, but that its topic is one of much misunderstanding and pain for a lot of people: pride and humility. What is pride? What is humility? What should we avoid? And Why is pride dangerous to prayer and our relationship with God? So I would like to start today by seeking to name these misunderstandings and then show how our parable more helpfully or correctly defines what they are and what we are to do about them. Okay, so let's get started. Well, the first big misunderstanding that I think you need to recognize is that the problem of pride is, the misunderstanding is that the problem of pride is loving oneself, and the cure is humility, which is self-loathing. That's often, I think, how people understand pride and humility. And I think we need to acknowledge that the sin of pride has an uneasy legacy among Christians. It has been used to rob others of feeling good about themselves or their accomplishments, as if that's really what pride is. I often find its wreckage amongst a younger generation that has so internalized this sort of notion that to be prideful is to be proud of oneself, and that to be humble is to loathe oneself, that they somehow believe that to be truly worthy of God's love, they must hate themselves. Or at the very believe that God somehow, before they became a Christian, or even while they are a Christian, hates them. Unfortunately, this misunderstanding of pride is actually exemplified by a saint that I often quote to you, who I dearly love. You know, he's a saint. He's not perfect. He doesn't get everything right. But Augustine, I think, misunderstands what pride is by defining it as the love of one's own excellence. This misunderstanding, when seen in that light, looks just like this cartoon that I'm going to show you on the screen. This guy praying, and he says, "Dear Lord, why did you make pride a sin and then make me so awesome?" Well, I think pride and the problem of our Pharisee is something else. Self-love is not inherently wrong or sinful. We know this just by simply listening to Jesus. In the greatest commandment and the golden rule, Jesus taught us that we are to love our neighbors as ourselves and to treat others as we would wish to be treated. So we have not told the story of the gospel rightly, nor understood our parable correctly, if we imagine that it's teaching us to say, "I'm dirty, awful, wicked, terrible, nasty, abhorrent, trashy, a loser, but God still loves me." Friends, being loved and forgiven by God does not demand poor self-esteem. Being loved by God doesn't require anything. So you are not prideful if you like yourself. If you're proud of what you do. Yesterday I was out in my front yard, and the next door neighbor boy, about 10 years old, went by on his skateboard, and he gave a big, "Woohoo! I'm awesome!" And you know what? He was awesome. How great that he could celebrate that. And humility, of course, is not captured by thinking poorly of yourself. Stating the reality that I am a sinner is not a declaration of worthlessness, as if sin has more of a power to define you than God's love and grace do. So to the Pharisees among us who delight in fasting and giving, great. There's nothing wrong with that. And these are good things. God loves obedient givers. That was not his problem. Being proud of what you have accomplished or what you have done is not necessarily pride. And to the tax collectors among us who inwardly or outwardly beat their breast or hang their heads in shame, God says to you, before you do or say anything, you are loved. Now lift up your head. Hear me. I don't want you to misunderstand. I am not saying that there isn't a deep brokenness in us, a sin that so easily entangles us, harms us, wounds us, hurts others, or undoes the world. I'm saying that you were made in love. You are saved in love. You are even judged in love. We have made sin wrongly synonymous with being unlovable when we should come to think of it as being incapable. So the problem of pride is not self-love, and the problem and the solution, the antidote, is not humility, which is self-loathing. Those are misunderstandings. So if we go back to our parable, what is the real problem of pride? Well, a better understanding is that pride is the failure to recognize that love is not a contest in which I compete with others for God's real affections. So if pride isn't so much the thought that I'm awesome, woohoo! What is it? Well, here we're helped by a different saint. This saint comes from the Italian Renaissance. His name is Dante Alighieri. And he defined pride as love of self perverted to hatred and contempt for one's neighbor. That's pride. It's when love of self becomes twisted so that it creates a competitive spirituality. And we see this in verses 9 and verse 11 of our parable, in which it's about competitiveness and beating and comparison. It's the belief that love is a limited resource, gives only select prizes, and is manifested by comparison and competition. My son, when he was very young, had this really funny thing he would do. Every time he would bring a kid over, he would introduce them in this way. He'd say, "Hey, Dad, this is Carter. He's my fourth best friend." It was almost like he was saying, "We're friends, but if you want to move up, you got to put in the work. I mean, spots are limited." The danger of pride, Jesus teaches us, is that the prideful person seems to imagine that the love of God is like a few life jackets on a sinking Titanic that we must fight over to truly stay alive. Pride is the idea that to be worthy of God's love is determined by some metric of comparison in which someone always has to lose. So to deal with pride then is not to imagine that you are terrible. To deal with pride is simply to realize that you are loved like everyone else. Your boss who cheated on his wife. Your cousin who can't seem to shake that drug addiction. That tax collector who defrauds others. And even you. You're all loved the same. See, the Pharisee, he can't see that he's both loved and broken like everyone else. which is why in his prayer, if you'll notice, he asks nothing of God. Notice that the text tells us that he stood by himself. He imagines that he has everything he needs because he's better than other people, whom he characterizes as thieves, rogues, adulterers, and tax collectors. He kind of stacks the deck, doesn't he? You know, he doesn't mention Mother Teresa, for example. So he imagines, what more can I ask of God than the high standing that I already enjoy? And so the prideful attitude, of course, is the problem. He not only imagines that love is a contest, he imagines that he has no need, that he has no wounds. It was interesting. I was thinking about the fact that in the early church fathers, they wrote a lot about pride and the temptations of the devil. And older monks would talk to younger acolytes, these younger monks, and would let them know that sometimes that the devil might appear to them looking like Jesus to tempt them, with religious thoughts, to have them do more than they were even capable of. But what was fascinating is that they nevertheless said, don't worry about it, because you can always tell when the devil is appearing like Jesus. Because when the devil appears as Jesus, they would say, in the guise of Jesus, he will have no wounds because he's too prideful to bear them. Friends, that's my encouragement for us. One of the ways to not be prideful, to not be like the Pharisee, is to always remember that we're loved like everyone else and that we are broken like everyone else. All of us have wounds, and we must bear them. The danger of pride is that it encourages us to ask God for nothing, to believe that we have no needs whatsoever, to find ourselves in the car of our spiritual lives, utterly lost, and yet refusing to ask for directions. The Pharisee's overblown sense of self seeks to build a wall between himself and sinners. But because God is always found with sinners and the humble, it's his own wall that keeps him out. Friends, if you cannot acknowledge your need, you leave yourself incapable to receive. That's the danger of pride. So pride, again, is not loving oneself. It's allowing one's love of oneself to twist it toward a haughtiness or disdain of others. This comparison metric, competitive spirituality. But what about humility? What's a better understanding of humility? Well, humility, again, is not self-loathing, but the recognition of need. In the Catholic Mass, each week, Catholics all around the world join in a Latin prayer that anchors deep within the Gospels and the earliest church's worship, and actually that comes from our parable today. So this week, again, it's not Greek of the week, but the Latin of the week. They pray or sing, Kyrie eleison, Christe eleison. Kyrie eleison, Lord, have mercy. Christ, have mercy. Lord, have mercy. But what do we mean when we pray, Lord, have mercy? Some may say we're asking God to not punish us for our sin, to not rain down fury and violent retribution on our lives. And I can see that there is a place for that. Not because God hates us, but because sin is destructive toward others, toward ourselves. It harms our world. It must not go unchecked. But perhaps it's more correct to think that asking for God's mercy is like saying, "We beg you for mercy to be with us, because ours is not enough. We ask for your wisdom to be with us, your loving kindness to be with us, because we just don't have enough of our own, and we keep messing everything up. We beg because we need help, because we're broken, much more so than we're bad. And we beg for others because we remember how much it hurts to hurt." In verse 14, Jesus says, "I tell you, this man, the humble one, went down to his house justified rather than the other." It's interesting that Jesus does not tell us that the tax collector offers to refund ill-gotten money, as Zacchaeus will do in Luke chapter 19, 8. He does not say that the tax collector will change his ways and become respectable. The tax collector makes no offer to play the personal achievement game. He only acknowledges that he is a sinner and that he is incapable. But what about the Pharisee? Is he lost? Who is this parable for? What is this parable about? And this is where, again, it's interesting to me that commentators can so seemingly get this wrong. The first thing I think we really need to know is that this is a parable that is about disciples of Jesus. It is not between disciples and detractors, between believers and unbelievers, between sinners and saints. That is not what this parable is about. It's easy to fall into that trap because the Pharisees were a group of people, and yet here, they don't reflect the group of people, they reflect a prideful believer. And we know this because if you look at the context for our parable, you have to go back to chapter 17, verse 22 to know who the audience is. And the audience, we are told, is only disciples. So the tax collector and the Pharisees are two different kinds of believers who need something from God. And then that, when we recognize that, then we realize that the justification that's talked about is not in this kind of eternal salvation sort of way. That's not what the parable is about. It's about the danger of pride for kingdom people. If you look at verse 14, it says that God will lift up the humble and lower the prideful. God will deal with both. God doesn't abandon one for the other, but works with both to bring them to God's intended end. God will raise up the humble believer and lower the proud believer so that they can be in right relationship with each other, themselves, and God. He'll deal with both of them so that they can stand together in the same place. We have four children. Here's a picture of them. And like all children, when they were a lot younger, they wanted to know where they stood. Was there a hierarchy of love? How did they measure up? Was one loved more than the other? Was one loved less? And my wife, Marianne, had this wonderful approach that showed so much wisdom and grace. I'd like to think that it's very much like the mind of God toward us. She would always end each conversation with one of our children, each moment on the phone, each snuggle on the couch, each time of even discipline with the child by saying, "Always remember, you are my favorite." And sure enough, the others would hear this declaration of love and know that it was true. It was true when they worked hard and made great accomplishments. It was true when they utterly failed, acted pridefully, felt ashamed or lost or afraid. It was also true for their brothers and sisters. And friends, whether you stand here today a Pharisee or tax collector, this one thing is true. You are his favorite. And because of that, he will either raise you up or bring you down because he loves you. Let that truth lead you into prayer, into a relationship with God. As I was thinking about that competitive spirituality this week, and even the ways it can corrupt how we respond and pray to God, I was reminded of Mary Oliver's poem that she wrote called Praying. Let's read it together. It doesn't have to be the blue iris. It could be weeds in a vacant lot or a few small stones. Just pay attention, then patch a few words together and don't try to make them elaborate. This isn't a contest, but the doorway into thanks and a silence into which another may speak.